Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Darren Willoughby as my special expert guest. Dr. Willoughby holds a Bachelor of Science and Master of Education degrees in exercise science from Tarleton State University and a PhD in exercise physiology with a sub-emphasis in nutritional biochemistry from Texas A&M University. He is a fellow of the ACSM and ISSN. He is also the current president of the International Society of Sports Nutrition and is a certified strength and conditioning specialist from the NCSA and a certified sport nutritionist from the ISSN. Dr. Willoughby is an internationally recognized scholar. His primary research focuses on the molecular mechanisms regulating muscle hypertrophy and atrophy as a result of resistance exercise and/or nutritional supplementation. Good morning, Darren, and thanks very much for participating as my special expert guest on this edition of SNU.
Thanks, Corey. I'm looking forward to it. It's an honor.
Now, for the benefit of those and our listeners who are not familiar with Baylor, perhaps you could tell us what Baylor is known for and what role you play down there.
Well, I guess probably first and foremost, Baylor is primarily known for having a pretty lousy football team and finding themselves on the bottom rung in the Big 12 South. But no, actually, seriously, Baylor's traditionally been known for exceptional institution of higher learning that's primarily governed by Christian faith. This is a Baptist-oriented institution. And so it's unique from the standpoint that while the faculty here are held to high standards of scholarship, teaching included, but research and service to the university, the profession, the community, we're also held to the highest standards relative to incorporating our Christian faith into the teaching and mentoring of students as well. In regards to my particular role in our Department of Health, Human Performance, and Recreation, as of almost 4 years ago, the department actually was renovated, if you will, from the standpoint that our master's program was revitalized with an exercise physiology emphasis, and we also started a new PhD program in exercise nutrition, health, and preventative rehab. And so in that particular context, primarily what I do is I was brought in to start a research laboratory and also teach primarily in the graduate program. So I teach only students in our master's and PhD program, primarily in courses relevant to exercise physiology, exercise biochemistry, muscle physiology, sport nutrition, and then also my laboratory carry out research projects that are somewhat commensurate to what my research interests are that you mentioned earlier. So with that in mind, that's my primary role here in the short of it.
Now, what is your take on sports nutrition? This is relatively new as a curriculum being taught in a university. Do you find that there's a lot of interest in students there?
Absolutely. We found that just in the last 2.5 to 3 years, our enrollment in our graduate program, particularly from students having a keen interest in exercise and sport nutrition, has just increased a significant amount. Our graduate enrollment has basically almost tripled from where it was about 4 years ago, and that's particularly at the master's level, but also at the doctorate level. And we find students that are applying to come here at the doctorate level, a lot of international students, students coming over from, for instance, from China and Sweden, for instance, England. We're developing a very rich diversity of graduate students that all have relative similar interests in both exercise science, physiology, but also exercise nutrition as well. It's actually quite surprising to even myself.
That's fantastic. Now, you're the Associate Professor of Exercise, Nutritional Biochemistry, and Molecular Physiology, and Director of the Exercise and Biochemical Nutrition Laboratory. And when Trace and I met you, we were very impressed with the caliber of your physique. It's obvious that you're committed to training, and it's been part of your lifestyle. I know that we had a great discussion, and I learned that it's always been a part of your lifestyle, and you have a massive interest in health. Has your academic background helped you in your own progressive lifestyle for health and fitness?
Oh, absolutely. Matter of fact, they probably go hand in hand. For instance, I've always been involved in sports, athletics, exercise, fitness to some extent, and I found myself being drawn to this particular field in which I'm involved in professionally as a result of my significant interest in sports and athletics. And also in so doing that, you know, when I was done playing competitive sports in college, at least until I started playing semi-professional football a few years after that, then I started actually competing in bodybuilding. And so that being the case, particularly from that particular standpoint and just the keen interest that I've always had in how our bodies respond to exercise and adapt to different types of exercise, as I said earlier, is really what sparked my interest in exercise physiology and exercise science, and also the applications that nutrition that are integrated into this particular field. And so that being the case, that I found that, you know, over the years, as I continue to train, for instance, and compete in bodybuilding, and I'd like to start competing again here fairly soon in the Masters division, I found that my training has actually changed somewhat. My training principles, also my nutritional principles, my nutritional guidelines, you know, all those things that are involved in actually driving my training has significantly come about as a result of, you know, what I've learned over the years as a result of my academic preparation. It's been quite powerful, to be quite honest with you, in that, you know, it's, and I tell my students this on a regular basis, is it's really nice to be able to kind of use yourself as a guinea pig, so to speak, but also kind of put science into practice, whether it's in someone else, but particularly in yourself. And so, while it's very, very intriguing and interesting to me, it's also fun.
You mentioned your own training principles and nutrition principles. Can you give us an example of a training principle that you've altered or changed because of knowledge that you've acquired in your field?
Well, I would say probably first and foremost in regards to training is that I don't have to train as heavy in terms of load day in and day out, training session in and training session out. And I found that over the course of time is that I felt like I've actually been able to develop better quality gains and lean mass by actually reducing my load somewhat and keeping my repetitions relatively high. And when I say relatively high, you know, upwards of about anywhere between, say, 10 to 12, maybe even upwards of 15, rather than training more like a power lifter like I used to do in my early days in bodybuilding. Even though I did do a little bit of power lifting, I never really enjoyed it that much as opposed to bodybuilding. But anyway, and so that being the case, I found that for myself, my body seems to respond much more appropriately to more higher volume type of training, where I'm not training with as heavy load, but yet I'm actually training with higher amount of repetitions. And so it's interesting that we just did a study just this past spring where we actually attempted to look at different training intensities and volumes and looked at some of the molecular mechanisms in muscle that are actually involved in upregulating protein synthesis. And even though the results of this study are yet to be published, we're in the manuscript developmental phase right now, but we were finding some interesting results that were quite dramatic in suggesting that more higher volume types of training are actually more effective at instigating some of these changes that are associated with upregulations in muscle protein synthesis. So I'm kind of giving you a long-winded answer to your question, but it gets back to my standpoint that even though I've kind of known that my own body seem to, for instance, respond favorably to this over the course of the last, say, 7 or 8 years, that when we actually began to start putting some of this into the research development phases, that we're beginning to see that there are some changes that seem to be suggestive of that.
Do you think this becomes more of an important issue as we age? Like, I'm 49, and well, how old are you now?
42.
So, say, post-40, you know, that heavy load that we are used to withstanding when we're younger, that becomes more of a risk, I think, for the joint capsule and for damage. Isn't that true?
I would agree. I certainly know that while I can train as hard and heavy as I could when I was, you know, 27 or 28, what I find is that, you know, it's harder for me to do that day in and day out. And I think what you're suggesting is exactly the case. I mean, we know that, you know, the wear and tear on the connective tissue and the soft tissue is very, you know, can be very dramatic, particularly if it's something that we've been doing for, you know, a relatively long period of time. So I think in my own case, I find that if I try to continue to do that on a regular basis, I really notice a difference in regards to how my joints feel. And if my joints don't feel particularly good, then it's hard for me to really train as hard as I'd like to in the weight room, even if I am going with lower intensity. So I found myself, for several reasons, age being one of them, kind of moving away from the really heavy types of resistance training and moving more towards the lower resistance but higher volume types of programs.
How does this relate then to, you know, the fast and intermediate and slow twitch fibers? Because the way I train, for example, is I know that I've got fast and intermediate and slow twitch fiber makeup in my body. Don't we need like the lower reps, the intermediate and the higher rep range to truly activate all of them for complete development?
Yeah, you're right. You know, over a given set or usually is that we find ourselves, you know, being able to, depending on the intensity that we're working at, is that we typically, what we find is that the different fibers will find themselves in some cases being recruited at different levels throughout a given set and over the course of a given exercise as we begin to fatigue, so that some fibers that were kind of, you know, that might lie relatively dormant early on in a set or maybe at the first couple of sets of the actual exercise that we're doing may end up becoming much more active in the later stages as the muscle itself begins to fatigue. And so some of those fibers that might have been lying somewhat dormant may become more preferentially recruited as they're trying to actually assist the muscle in carrying out the exercise.
Now, regarding the muscle fibers, the sliding filament concept or theory, are you aware of any new data that's challenging that or that has sort of updated our knowledge in terms of, you know, how muscles contract in an all or nothing principles and they sort of slide across each other with sarcomeres? Is there anything new to add to that model, say, in the last couple of years?
No, not that I'm aware of. Right now, that seems to be back in the day of A.F. Huxley. You know, his work was seminal from the standpoint that he was the one that basically came up with that theory of the sliding filament theory, and then after a period of time, then that particular theory began to be challenged. And what's kind of interesting is that after a period of time, researchers began to find out that his theory seemed to be the most prevalent one. And so that particular case is that, from what I'm aware, that seems to be the well accepted theory regarding muscle contraction by activation, and that it's the contractile unit, the sarcomeric unit, that contains the contractile and regulatory and structural proteins that collectively are responsible for carrying out that type of activity. So to answer your question, I'm not aware of any type of any new data that's attempting to challenge that theory.
Now, when a load is placed on the muscle and you're liberating a force and that disturbs the environment and that leads to muscle hypertrophy, you know, in simple terms, what's actually going on inside the tissue with the fibers responding that the way they do that leads to, you know, the increase in the diameter or the neurological efficiency?
Well, actually, that's a good question. It's what we're finding out more and more all the time, and even with much of my work, is that that's actually a very, even though, it, you know, when when one kind of talks through it, generally it sounds like a relatively simplistic process, but we're finding out that it's not necessarily the case, and that it's a highly regulated, integrated process that's regulated by various types of hormones, growth factors. For instance, you know, testosterone and insulin growth factor 1, for instance, and some of these other factors that systemically, once released into circulation, actually can carry out effects inside muscle, downstream effects inside muscle. And when I say effects inside muscle, then that typically comes from the standpoint of activating various muscle-specific genes that will be expressed and then subsequently translated into new proteins. And those new proteins will then be incorporated into the sarcomeric matrix within the myofibril. And then, of course, we find ourselves enlarging myofibrillar density, and then that, of course, translates into an overall increase in muscle fiber cross-sectional area, which then subsequently increases into whole muscle cross-sectional area. So really, what we find is that hypertrophy in and of itself, which can be augmented by just contraction per se, just perturbations to muscle, stress and strain, what we call mechanical disruption to the muscle itself, which can actually lead to tearing and injury to the sarcolemma, to the membrane that makes up that surrounds the muscle fibers. And that typically what we find is that when that occurs, then there's actual kind of a parallel process or pathway in which the cytoskeletal architecture will be repaired by repair mechanisms that go on within the cell as well. So it's, you know, it's kind of like the analogy that many times people hear is that you start with a small brick wall when you start out resistance training, and that every so often with your resistance training, you begin to knock pieces of the bricks out of the wall, and then when you rebuild the wall, you then actually add a few more bricks to the wall, and so that after a certain amount of time, you've actually increased the size of the wall dramatically, somewhat commensurate with the amount of time that you've trained and maybe the amount of effort that you've put into training as well. But, you know, you can't necessarily explain muscle hypertrophy only by the concept of mechanical disruption, because that in and of itself and the recovery mechanisms that are somewhat hormonally regulated, and then it's simply the mechanisms that go along with the upregulation of muscle-specific genes that lead to increases in muscle protein synthesis are, even though somewhat related, but they're also somewhat independent processes that we know occur during resistance exercise.
Well, thanks for that excellent explanation, Darren, and the good analogy on the brick wall. That really helps people get that message, I think. And as a teacher, I think you're well aware of the fact that some of these complex mechanisms are really hard to integrate into our mind, but you probably have discovered yourself that the analogies help get that message across. The influence of myostatin. Now, what's going on in that area?
We don't know. Not to diminish it in any way. Myostatin, also known as growth differentiation factor 8, is a very, very interesting protein from the standpoint that we know that it is definitely a negative regulator of muscle mass. But in the adult, is that its primary effects seem to be more irrelevant to issues of muscle wasting, where individuals are in a primary catabolic situation, catabolic state, that may do to, you know, immobilization, you know, disuse, atrophy, immobilization, could even be due to situations of maybe sarcopenia that could be, there's really no data to suggest to that effect that one, you know, one is dependent on the other, but it's probably more of a causal effect. But we also know in situations of a muscle wasting disorder such as cancer, cachexia, for instance, HIV and AIDS, there are data in humans showing increases in the amount of serum or circulating myostatin, and also in the increase in the amounts of myostatin protein in muscle. I think probably more from the standpoint of what the data seems to suggest, that myostatin's involvement in developmentally, it seems to be from the standpoint of having effect on the differentiation of muscle cells from what we call baby muscle cells, as they begin to grow and proliferate over time and differentiate into adult muscle fibers, is that myostatin seems to primarily play a role in regulating that particular process of muscle fiber development. And much of that data, however, because of the types of models used, come from animal models. You know, it's very difficult to study human muscle fibers from that particular standpoint, even if they're, you know, even if they're cultured, but from the standpoint of looking at animal models where rodent data, for instance, has given us quite a bit of insight into the role of that myostatin may play developmentally. Even its effect on satellite cell activation as well seems to be somewhat of an interesting scenario. And very quickly, myostatin is its mode of action is quite unique from the standpoint that skeletal muscle genes will be expressed and increase the amount of myostatin protein in muscle. Once that happens initially, then that particular protein is what's said to be unprocessed. It's immature. And then as the muscle will then release that immature myostatin into the circulation. And as that's happening, then the myostatin will actually undergo a process where it becomes proteolytically cleaved so that it becomes mature. And when that happens, then it's typically will be circulating in blood in its mature processed state. Now, when that happens, however, it needs to undergo an additional proteolytic cleavage step by various types of enzymes or other factors that we don't really fully understand, not in vivo, not in the intact systemic physiology that we have, that can cause myostatin to be activated. And once activated, then it has the ability to bind to receptors in muscle and then signal in muscle and cause some of these downstream intracellular effects that are going to be primarily more catabolic in nature. So again, what happens is that muscle synthesizes myostatin, releases it into the bloodstream, and then it turns around and comes back and then exerts its effects back in muscle. So it's not like, for instance, something where you've got like the adrenal gland secreting cortisol into the bloodstream, and then that can actually have its effect on muscle this way. You're talking about a situation where muscle, synthesizes a protein that releases itself, and then reflexively has the ability to then turn around and exert its effects back in muscle. So it's very, very, very unique type of process in which this occurs, and exactly why and how and the full extent of it, we're still in the infantile stages of trying to figure that out. So, long-winded answer, but there you go.
Well, this is the power of the digital record. We're able to go back and listen to what you've stated over and over again, and this is why SNU is a powerful tool for people for learning and education. They can play this and listen to it and really get this information down. And for that, we thank you very much. Darren, our time is gone, and we've got time for one more question. But before we ask you that question, is there a website that you would recommend to our listeners who have an interest in what you've been talking about and what you're doing?
Well, I would say just our general Baylor website is www.baylor.edu, or you could go to baylor.edu/HHPR. Health, Human Performance, and Recreation, and that would get you into our actual departmental website. But our, you know, the university website it's easily piloted, so our department can be found very easily, and links to my lab and to my research and ongoing activities that we have are pretty easy to find. And then that being the case, then somebody can actually find my email address on our website, and they're more than welcome to email me if they would like.
Thank you very much. Now, my final question is, we're all aging and we are starting to understand more about the forces of oxidation and sarcopenia and the things that are working against us. But do you believe it's possible as a man in your age bracket and mine as well, and even older, is it possible to stay well lifelong, to build muscle, to maintain a state of vibrancy, to avoid morbidity and to avoid that accumulation of body fat around the midsection. Is that truly possible, or is that just an expectation that's not tied in with reality?
No, I think it's a very realistic expectation. I mean, one great thing about the human body is it's so unbelievably adaptable. And the one thing about skeletal muscle is it's so unbelievably plastic. And when we say plastic, it means it has the ability to adapt and change what we call its phenotype. And so in so doing, I mean, there are studies I've even conducted some myself with, you know, with elderly, putting them on a weight training program, like 10 or 12 week weight training program. And you know, after the course of time, these individuals have increased their strength like, you know, 40-50%, and you know, and undergone increases in lean mass, and for instance, and improved body composition. And for instance, my studies are not the only ones, because I mean, the literature is full of those types of studies to show, you know, the power of being able to continue to improve health outcomes and quality of life measures and such, and as we age. And so that being the case, I think not only exercise, but I think, you know, the power of proper, prudent nutrition needs to be also stated in that as well. And you mentioned earlier about antioxidants, you know, having a diet that's high in antioxidant-containing foods, so that we can reduce the consequences of oxidative stress as we age. As we know, those are typically elevated, and so on and so forth. I mean, it all fits in together to paint a very, very beautifully an elaborate integrated picture that, you know, I think that we all should be very motivated by.
Dr. Darren Willoughby has been my special expert guest on this edition of SNU. He's recognized internationally as a scholar, and he is the associate professor of exercise nutritional biochemistry and molecular physiology at Baylor University. Darren, we thank you very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Representing lifestyle, new way of life. Listen, it's SNU, sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight, Malik with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life, live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHawley.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see ya changing heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.